Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on DLive.TV/Dave Martell. Live every single Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. If you like The Bog, you support The Bog, you want to see The Bog grow, make sure to go over to patreon.com/TheBog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. And there's all kinds of cool stuff over there. You can get the RSS feed so you can listen to the audio of every single episode of The Bog on your commutes, at the gym, in the car, at work, wherever. Really, really great stuff over there. So if you like The Bog, make sure to go sign up at patreon.com/TheBog. If you want to support us another way, make sure to go to shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop and get some sweet merch, man. Get some sweet merch. Get some t-shirts. Get some an artisan chef apron. You could get all kinds of cool stuff there. Hats, beanies, and, you know, just, man, it's chilly out there. And I'm usually saying us in the north being chilly because it's wintertime. But, man, those guys, our boys in the south, are getting hammered right now. So you guys in the south that never bought a hoodie before, why not make your first hoodie a Bog hoodie? Go support The Bog at shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop and pick up some sweet merch. Also, you go to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish, as you can see up there in the top left corner. Really, really cool stuff, man. Our boy Neil John, we interviewed him a couple months back. We interviewed him twice. He's an incredible, incredible guy. His work is incredible. So if you're interested in some authentic Vedic astrology, go over to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. And if you decide to get a birth chart, get to see what the stars are saying about you, tell him Big Dave sent you. Tell him your boy Big Dave sent you. So tonight, Mr. Wolfman is not going to be joining us. So it's just me, Tristan, and Andre. What's going on, guys?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. How about you, Andre?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good myself.
Tonight we are going to talk about something really, really cool. Something that's not as quite as sexy as, you know, I love watching historical, like, you know, YouTube channels and videos and documentaries. We all do, right? If you go to YouTube and you go look up ancient technology, specifically talking about Germanic cultures, ancient Germanic cultures, what are you going to find? You're going to find tons and tons, thousands of videos talking about spears and shields and swords and helmets and all of this kind of stuff. And those things are great and those things are awesome and we love reading and hearing about them. We're going to talk about some of that stuff tonight too. But there's not a lot of coverage on some of the more practical, pragmatic technology that our ancestors developed, which in my opinion are very, very overlooked and really, really reveal how ingenious and creative these people were, and goes to the idea and the understanding that our ancestors were not primitive people. They were not these backwards, Stone Age, illiterate, dumb, dirty people. They were very, very intelligent. They had industry. They had technology and all of this kind of stuff. Now, when we talk about technology, the word technology, when people think technology, they think machines. They think computers. They think aircraft carriers. They think machine guns. They think, you know, all this kind of stuff. Advanced technology. And when we talk about technology, ancient technology, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? The first thing that comes to your mind is probably going to be ballistas and trebuchets and great warships and stuff like that. But in actuality, the word technology, the definition of technology, is the implementation of technique. So this covers a very wide array of things that are technology. Not all of them are material. For example, language is a technology. It is an implementation, a grouping of techniques, right? Anything could be a technology. Technology is really what defines us as a race, as a species, type of animal, I guess you could say. So when we talk about technology and the importance of technology, what often gets overlooked, in my opinion, are the smaller things like adhesives, things like what do people make nails out of, tar, what were the techniques that led to building the ships, how did they cast their metal, how did they cast their metallurgy. How did they do their blacksmithing? How did they do these things to make these awesome weapons and this awesome armor that we see on the YouTube channels? So we're going to get into some of that stuff tonight. And unfortunately, Mr. Tristan did have some pictures for the stuff that he was talking about, and I completely forgot to upload it. But I'm going to try to dig through our chat and bring that stuff up as we're talking, and we're going to try to get some visuals up here. So without further ado, you know, Mr. Andre and Tristan have some stuff. We all picked a few different topics to talk about, and I would like, you know, since we're talking about swords and whatnot, Mr. Tristan was actually going to tell us about some of their techniques of smithing, and I'd like to get started with that. Mr. Tristan.
Yeah, this is a very good intro topic here, and it's actually one of the most complicated and useful smithing techniques that humans have ever developed, which is something we don't really think about when we think about, you know, Norsemen and Vikings and everything. We don't think super technical, well-invented smiths, so that sort of thing. But it really is true. So what I'm talking about here is called the alternating twist method of forging. And what they would do was they would take a high-carbon steel, which is steel with a very high carbon content, makes it very hard. And they would take a low-carbon steel, which is very soft and malleable, and they would combine the two into like a V shape, where they'd put the high carbon steel on the outside and the low carbon steel on the inside, and spread them together like a V. And then once those two would hammer them together, and then they'd twist the metal like a corkscrew, and then pound it out so that all the metal would become, you know, make an even layer, and then they'd twist it again like a corkscrew and make a layer. And it's sort of like the famous Japanese method of forging steel, how they dealt with their poor iron quality by, you know, the whole folding it over on itself and beating it a million times kind of thing. Except the Norse method was actually much more useful, much quicker, and produced a much stronger blade because of the corkscrew technique through twisting it.
Yeah, I just brought the images up on the screen right now, and it shows the technique, and they have the more malleable, softer metal in the middle, and then they put the harder stuff on the outside. You can see here layers A on either side, and then layers B on the inside. And then you can see to the right here, there is the metal that actually is twisted here by the smith. And Mr. Tristan, this was actually a very good technique, right? This doesn't get as much love as, say, like the folding of the Japanese. This is a superior style of smithing, is it not?
Oh, it is absolutely superior, and it is very close in concept to the idea of Damascus steel or the Japanese method, but it's basically just an innovative improvement upon it.
Very good. Very good. So I'm going to take a minute to bring up some of Andre's pictures and stuff like that. If you want to take it away and talk about some of the other stuff you had lined up for us tonight. Tristan?
Oh, my bad. I thought you were going to Andre.
Nah.
Anyway, I'll go down to my next one, which is the magnetic compass, which I'm sure everyone is rather familiar with. The Norsemen actually invented the magnetic compass in Europe through the use of the mineral magnetite, which is also referred to as lodestone. And it's a very abundant mineral in Scandinavia, which is why they had access to it, but a lot of other people didn't. It's pretty rare outside of that. The only other people who invented it up until, I think, the 15th...
Mr. Dresden, you're cutting out, sir. Tristan's been having some trouble with his internet out there in Arizona, so we'll wait
until he kept it.
Mr. Tristan, you cut out real bad. We lost you when you were about to say 15th century,
right?
I believe.
The 15th century, up until then, the only people who had a magnetic compass was China. And for hundreds and hundreds of years, Norsemen had magnetic compasses, which they used to sail through thick fog or cloud covers or situations like that, where other people just simply could not find their bearings. And this wasn't spread to the rest of Europe or anything else like that for maybe 800 years, something of that sort.
Wow. That's incredible. And this, obviously, the magnetic compass was useful in effectively them having an edge navally, right? Being able to navigate the seas with that kind of accuracy was something that just was not available yet. And as you said, wasn't available for centuries afterwards.
Yeah, that's entirely correct. And also, I mean, it has uses for land navigation as well, for the same reason we use compasses today. I mean, that goes to show you, we literally use compasses today on ships and land navigation.
Wow. So the Norsemen invented the compass, I guess you could say. Incredible. So also tonight, I wanted to talk about, I know Andre, when he gets going, he is going to talk about ships, and he is going to blast us with ship naval knowledge, nautical knowledge. So I wanted to talk about a little bit of something that led into a lot of the shipbuilding and stuff like that. And I'm sure Mr. Andre is going to probably touch on some of these items. But I wanted to talk about something that was very mundane, but was monumentally important when it came to ideas of craftsmanship and industry and building and fixing things and everything from building ships to building houses to building whatever you can think of. These items were 100% necessary, and they're necessary today too. And that is glue and adhesives, as well as tar. Now, when you think of glue and adhesives, you know, we don't think about it that much anymore because, you know, you need some glue, you get some Elmer's, there's wood glue, you know, there's not a lot of people really deal with glue a lot unless you're like a kindergarten teacher or something like that. You know, we don't really think about it that much. However, in the days where you had to build your own house, you had to make your own tools, you had to make the stuff that's in your kitchen and in your living room and the bed that you sleep on, when you made literally everything, glue was 100% absolutely necessary. It was one of the lifebloods of craftsmanship forever. We're talking from the BC times all the way up until like now. It's just we don't have a hand in crafting all of our stuff around our house as much anymore, you know, because of commercialism and, you know, so on and so forth. We can get into all of that stuff. But how did they make glue? You know, when we think of glue now, we think of, you know, like I said, Elmer's and stuff like that. We don't even really, you know, we think about glue. How would they have made glue? You know, we don't really take into account how these people made these very mundane things, and they made a lot of it, too. So when you talk about glue, there is really kind of two ways that they made glue back then. And this is a way that they made glue for thousands. We're talking Bronze Age, Iron Age, all throughout the ancient North. This is how they made glue. And what it's called is a protein colloid. And what a protein colloid is effectively the collagen they extract from, you know, animal matter via a process called hydrolysis. And what hydrolysis is effectively separating the water and the moisture from something to make it a certain texture. And this colloid stuff is also very similar to Jell-O, like how we would understand Jell-O to be. It's the same kind of thing, right? So it's not a far-fetched to believe that they also had like gelatin food too. They probably knew how to do that. But obviously, we can't prove that because there's no, you know, remnants of Jell-O left over from 1,000 years ago. You can't really preserve Jell-O for that long. But what these people did is they boiled down this animal matter, the collagen, and they effectively separated it from the water, or maybe they steamed it, or there's many different processes they could have used, and they turned it into a glue. Another thing that they did, and this was a similar process, is they did the same thing with like milk curds, and sometimes they would mix these two things together, and what this made was a very long-lasting, very strong, I mean, I watched some videos of some folks that made this stuff, and they used it. It takes a very, very long time to set, but the strength of it is unbelievable. It's far stronger than, say, your Elmer's wood glue that you buy at the store. It was truly incredible that they developed this stuff. I thought I heard one of you guys were about to chime in.
Well, I was about to say something a little earlier to say that even though we don't have any definitive information that they ate like gelatin foods, it is rather common in Scandinavia to have jellied foods even today. So it's quite likely.
Yeah, it's quite likely. It's quite likely that they used it as like a preservative technique. That's something that still gets used today. You know, they had the technology. So to think that they had this, they knew how it worked, and they didn't use it is a little bit far-fetched, in my opinion. The next up that I wanted to talk about was tar. Now, when you think of tar, you think of, you know, this black sludge and stuff like, and it's not really something, unless you're a roofer, it's not something that you really interact with as a modern person. But tar was another thing, and I'm sure Andre is going to touch on tar. because tar was so monumentally important to shipbuilding. But tar effectively, and this is something that has just been starting, we've started to learn about over the past 10, 15 years, really. This is a very recent understanding of the northern people. They produced large-scale industrial, they had a whole tar industry. They made the best tar, and it's very possible that they sold this stuff all over the place, and it was one of their things that they monopolized, because the Norse people, the Germanic people, had a monopoly on trade throughout all of medieval Europe. We're talking not even just through the medieval Europe, but in the Bronze Age, too. These people were immense traders. Now, obviously, in the Bronze Age, there was some, they were competing with Rome and stuff, but as far as them having trade routes into the Slavic world and the Celtic world, these were people that made money. These were people that were striving to get rich with everything that they did, and they did it very, very well. And then going into the medieval periods, the Norse had a stranglehold. Up until the two cultures got integrated and stuff like that, the Norse, because of the development of their ships, because of all these things, they had a monopoly on medieval European trade. They were just excellent traders, and it was because of their ship design. It was because of they were very business minded. They had a lot of great law. They were just perfect for it. They were great tradesmen and businessmen. That's just who they were. So when we talk about tar, they did not know the scale in which these people produced tar, which was one of the most important building materials throughout all of the world. You needed this stuff to insulate houses, to build houses, build roofs, to line your ships. Everything worked on tar, everything. So these guys, when they're finding these tar pits now, so a quick example on how they made tar. They made tar was they would take wooden planks, and they would have them. They would burn, but not burn like having flames and stuff. They would smolder, and they would put charcoal and clay, like earth and clay, a layer of clay over top of this stuff. So it was this very slow, very hot, condensed heat on this wood that was restricted of oxygen, and they would put it in this gigantic like funnel shape, and all of the tar would slowly drip out into a pipe down into a vat. And some of this tar, some of these tar pits, the average tar pit that they found was about 50 to 80 gallons. That's a lot of tar. We're talking a lot of tar. Some of the big ones they estimated that they found could hold up to 1,000 gallons. We're talking 1,000 gallons of tar in these vats that these people would harvest. So we're talking these people produced building materials at a rate, and it was the best stuff because of the type of wood that they had up there and how how good the wood was. It was I forget what kind of trees were up there and stuff during this time, and they're still up there. But they would produce such large amounts of this high-quality tar that they would put it in barrels, and they would ship it around and make money off of the rest of Europe making this building material. It was a tremendous industry that they had, and we're now starting to see that it fueled the Viking Age, and it fueled European industry as a whole, the Norse and Germanic production of tar. And I'm sure Mr. Andre is going to talk about tar a little bit in the construction of ships. So I'm going to bring up his images. And Mr. Andre, tell us a little bit about the ship industry during in the times of the ancient Norse.
Just to touch upon what you just mentioned here, two things that you mentioned. Specifically, the first thing is the tar. The aspect of tar, as you said, was vitally important. Specifically, what they made in Scandinavia was primarily pine tar. And pine tar was always historically used. It had several different applications, but one of the most major ones was used for impregnating wood. It functioned as a sealant and waterproofing, but it also protected woods in general that might be subject to very harsh conditions, such as on the ocean and so forth, or by the coast, where you might get battered by rain and wind and so forth. It would essentially make their houses, their ships, waterproof. Secondly, trade. A vital aspect that a lot of people tend to forget about these people, as you said, in the Bronze Age and in the Medieval Age and the Viking Age and so forth, they think of the Norse and the Germanic people in general as great warriors. These people showed up to your shores, they beat the crap out of you, and then they left and took your stuff. That's not all what they did, though, because you touched on a very interesting point there, that they were not just feared for their warrior skills, they were also feared for their trading skills. You might be surprised on how often they felt threatened by how good the Norsemen were at trade and giving good deals and so forth. There's a reason why they somehow ended up in a monopoly situation in a lot of trade situations. Now, all of this was facilitated by essentially the Viking symbol, the Viking emblem itself, the longship, the dragon ship, the drakkar, whatever you have. There's several types, but what I specifically wanted to talk about is the construction method of these ships. The construction method is very unique. It's only found in Scandinavia. This was something that was developed in Scandinavia, and it started, its origins was essentially a method of sewing the ship together. You'd drill holes, and you'd sew the holes together with plant fibers or ropes, essentially. You didn't use nails. They later replaced this with nails and washers and made a riveting system. They riveted their ships together. This was unprecedented at the time. It was a mark of ingenuity to be able to do this. And this method became widely known as the clinker style, because I assume because of the sound that it makes, because of the clinking sound when you break off the nails. What you ended up with, and I don't know if you have the images up.
I do.
Yes, good. Compared to the normal caravel style, where you stack planks on top of each other and you kind of hammer them from both sides into the main skeleton of the ship, the clinker style of building is unique because it makes an overlapping plank system. The planks overlap each other, kind of like that of snake scales, I think you could say. They overlap each other, and each plank essentially has several points of contact, one at the bottom and one at the top, and several along the sides of where they connect to the main hull of the ship. The interesting thing to note here is that the clinker style ships, compared to the caravel style, was constructed the wrong way around. Instead of constructing the main skeleton and then stacking the planks on top of each other, you constructed the main hull first. You placed the keel and you placed the boards and you made the outer scale of it afterwards. Then you started adding in the later skeleton of the ship, the strakes and so forth, to fasten them and make them secure. This was done specifically to be able to customize and interchange interchange a little bit between how you might want the ship to perform, because several types of ships had different functions, but they all had a similar style of building. And for every step of the way, there was a lot of sealing going on. Everything had to be customized. Everything had to be cut to shape because there was no template to construct from. There was no template that people just knew. You couldn't just look something up. You didn't have a large book with all the different designs. No, this was basically passed down by oral tradition and experience by immensely experienced shipwrights and shipbuilders. And several hundreds of people might be working on this ship at the time, but the mastermind behind it all would more or less be one or a few people who knew exactly how things were supposed to fit, how things were supposed to go. But every step of the way, you have to narrow things down. You have to make things fit exactly to the main skeleton of the ship and the planks on the outside. This was done as well, like as you mentioned, with glue. It was done with metal rivets. It was done with metal nails. And later, tar would be applied in the joints to make sure things were watertight every step of the way. And you built it from the ground up, from the hull. You added a skeleton. And then you started adding things like the deck and the sails. Not the sails, the mast. And then you added the sails afterwards. That was the final step of the process. An interesting thing that I found after doing some more research on the specifics of making these rivets, that is very instrumental to make this clinker style boat, is that each rivet needed approximately 100 hammer strokes in order to be fastened securely, and these could have hundreds, if not possibly thousands, of rivets in order to make things as secure as they were. I hope that this was like not too confusing, because this is a really complicated process, and it was used extensively even in modern day Scandinavia and in the Viking Age. This method allowed these ships, these long ships, to have an immense carrying capacity, be that men or cargo. It allowed them unparalleled maneuverability, ludicrous speeds, a great deal of flexibility, and I think we touched upon this a little bit in the Norway episode, but to reiterate for those who didn't hear this, the flexibility of the longship was a result of its construction. Because of the method it was constructed, the ship wasn't rigid. Because of the overlapping planks and the kind of like the sewing method that they used with rivets, it allowed the planks to move so slightly. This was done by design, because if a ship is too rigid and it hits a harsh wave, it can snap, it can break. The long ships were specifically made so they could bend from side to side and up and down. It sounds fantastical. It sounds almost magical, and it sounds like, oh, now you're just making stuff up. But no, this is actually how they worked. And this is why these longships were absolutely, I would consider, the best ships at the time. The design and the method of this, they spread from Scandinavia and were later adopted in a lot of places in Northern Europe and Great Britain and Ireland and so forth. This was a tested and proven design. And just to also add another aspect of this that just makes them sound even more fantastical, and keep in mind, this is because this is more or less, and I have heard this said multiple times, that this is, they have made longship replicas, but in modern times with modern tools. And it took them 2 years to complete, and it was such a pain to do. It was a horrendous task to do. So when people come out and say that these are essentially engineering marvels, I can believe them. This was an immensely complicated and, as a result, expensive piece of technology.
Yeah, and these ships were really fast, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, most longships, they assume with good wind, with sails up, could probably travel between 15 and 16 knots. Testings have also proven that they would have been capable in extremely favorable conditions to reach speeds of 20 knots, which is on par with a lot of modern ferries and a lot of modern ships, large-scale ships. Incredibly fast.
Not only were they very fast, but they were also very light. I mean, we think that they were actually so light that they could be disembarked and the men could carry them over portages physically.
Yeah, that's another one. That's another interesting aspect, because like even the largest longship would sit maybe 3 or 4 feet in the water. That's it. Bigger ships tend to sink. Longship usually were broader the bigger they became, so they just constantly sat at a neat 3 or 4 feet in the water at any given time, which allowed them to traverse places like lakes and rivers. And if they came across a river and the river ended and they saw another river a few kilometers away, they could literally just lift the longship and carry it over to the next river and then keep on sailing. They also used them and flipped them around to make makeshift longhouses out of them if they didn't have any prior shelter.
Yeah, and to put it into perspective for people, the keel of of the longship that, as Andre was talking about, went maybe 3 or 4 feet deep, a comparable keel for the rest of Europe at the time for a similar ship would have been looking at somewhere between 12 and 20 feet.
Yeah.
They had great sizes too. Like, there was a great variety of sizes, but as I said, like, even the largest ones would sit very lightly in the water.
Yeah, these were really just majesties. These were engineering marvels at the time. This was an unparalleled piece of technology that dominated the medieval seas all over the world. This was the best boat in the world at the time and reigned for many, many years, centuries. And their designs were taken and used for later ships as well. Tristan said in the chat, was it King Harold or whatever, he had a ship, you said 35 meters long, and could use and would require a crew of a minimum of 100 men for Americans.
That's just oarsmen.
Yeah, that's just guys powering the ship. You know, I mean, that's the minimum crew to get the ship moving, meaning that you needed more guys if you wanted this thing to operate well. We're talking 150, 160 guys on this ship. For my Americans, you know, 35 meters, that's 115 feet. That's 115 feet. That's, what is that, five school buses.
And interesting note on that, too, the largest ship that was ever found historically, because what was mentioned there was more or less as like a saga ship. It's one of those ships that is mentioned in sagas but have never been found or confirmed, and some people just speculated that, of course, that could never have happened. But the largest ship that was found in Roskilde in Denmark, named Roskilde 6, and it was 118 feet long. This was a majestic warship. And as you say, yes, you could have 100, 120 men, and that would be the rowers. If you were fully equipped for war, an invasion fleet or something, you might have 200, 300 men, and that would be no problem for the ship to carry. It could carry a full load of men and immense amounts of cargo
and
without suffering
and
much. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, put into perspective, you said... you said school buses.
Mm-hmm.
You could also say this is larger than a blue whale, largest currently existing animal.
The chat is also asking us about lightweight smaller vessels for attacking, which I believe they were referred to as Snekja.
Yeah, the Snekja was primarily a cargo ship. It was far smaller. It was constructed in a similar manner. But it was also somewhat broader and deeper, so it tended to carry a lot of cargo. It had fewer men, though. It could have, like, 12 or maybe 24 rowers, and 24 would be a huge one. But 12 rowers, no problem. That would be the crew that would be necessary to carry a really impressive amount of cargo for the time. And these were made to navigate the coastal waters of places like Scandinavia, be that in the Baltic Sea around Sweden and in Denmark and the Straits there, the Atlantic Sea, but also the coast of Norway. The coast of Norway is probably one of the most hazardous areas of the North Atlantic to ever be, because the weather is really unpredictable and there's a lot of cliffs and there's a lot of bays and a lot of fjords that you need to take into consideration. These were made to handle that, no problem.
Yeah. These ships, you know, we're talking. This was the terror of the world. If you were sitting on the shore and you saw a few of these ships coming, you're done. You're looking at your doom coming to your shore. We're talking ships that, you know, four or five of these ships carried an entire army. We're talking 1,000 guys, horses, full armor, everything ready to obliterate you and everybody near you. This was serious firepower. These were engineering marvels. A lot of people don't really realize how absolutely massive and powerful and ahead of their time they were. This was like, it was during that time, you know, this was like inventing, this was like having, you know, I guess it would be like an airplane, having the first Air Force when nobody else had an Air Force. It was incredible.
Well, you know, it's actually kind of like paratroopers. One of the reason the Vikings were so successful was because they could get four of those boats and drop 1,000 people in a concentrated area for like, you know, a day, and then leave before anyone could actually muster up an army to be able to even attack them.
It was
unbeatable. Some of the largest invasion forces they mention has two sides of the conflict, each side fielding somewhere between 100 and 300 ships. These aren't boats. These are ships. These are warships.
That's also another thing they did for warships. They didn't fight like, you know, with cannons and everything like that we think of today as naval battles. What they did was they'd lash a bunch of the warships together to serve as a giant platform, and they'd just have land battles at sea with shield walls and everything.
Yeah.
And it's one thing that, like, the final thing I want to mention is that many people might know, and for those unaware, you have to keep in mind that this was most likely the first ever ship. The longship was probably the first ever ship to be able to traverse more or less the open Atlantic Ocean in order to make it from Scandinavia over to Greenland, over to Iceland, and then over to North America.
Yeah.
Because Iceland and Greenland there, but you get the picture. This was an impressive feat, and other ships would take until the 1400s to be able to do this.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody reads these goofy articles that modern academics try to push that, oh, there were Viking Muslims and everything because they had Arabic jewelry or like whatever, they had the Turkish thing. No, these guys, they didn't have, you know, they weren't like, you know, there weren't Muslim Vikings. What happened was they had so much reach that they got so far out into the world that they could just buy things and trade things wherever they wanted. They were just absolutely incredible. They were genius.
We actually have examples of Buddha figurines that we found in Sweden.
Yeah, they bought things, they traded things throughout the world so far that we will probably never know, that we couldn't even fathom. That's how incredible these people were.
It was honestly like most people consider like the reach of the Vikings to maybe stretch to, well, you know, the Atlantic islands of the Faroes and the Iceland, Greenland, and then further down to maybe France on the southernmost part. But no, these people traded and raided in Spain, in the Mediterranean, in Italy. They went as far as Baghdad by way of rivers. They went far into Russia. These people could literally use their ships and travel across land at immense speeds, more or less, just by using riverways.
Yeah, it was like their Indo-European ancestors that spread throughout the northern world with chariots. You know, it was like there was like the chariot of the sea at that time. It was incredible.
They were often called that, too. They were often called, like, wave horses or sea steeds as
Yeah,
well.
there's actually a theological connection here where the sort of, especially to do with ritual burials and everything, where our far distant ancestors would have used chariots, the Norse actually switched to using boats as a sort of symbol for that.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible. So, moving on, I wanted to, Tristan, you had some other stuff you wanted to talk about, right?
I do have one more invention that I had to talk about, and that is the invention of the bristled comb. You know, everyone knows what you have it. I'm sure everyone owns several of them in today's age. And, you know, Norsemen actually invented the bristled comb, which is just a regular sort of hair comb with, you know, teeth in it and everything like that. They were originally made from the bones and antlers of the red deer and traded widely, mass-produced. It's one of the most common finds we find in archaeological excavations of Norse periods because every man was expected to own a comb and was expected to be well-groomed. In fact, we have records that other medieval people considered the Norsemen to be so well-groomed and handsome that they were concerned about their wives' chastity, to put it mildly.
Yeah, that was written. Yeah, we've brought that up a few times. That was written down by the Christians of Northern Europe. They were concerned of the Norsemen coming there with their nice hair and their cologne and their pretty clothes and their dancing and singing and their masculine wiles, that they were concerned about it.
Oh, absolutely, and it's actually recorded in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles that they perpetrated a massacre against a bunch of Danes because they kept stealing everyone's wives and even the wives of nobility because they would willingly choose to be the concubines of these Norsemen.
There was something hilarious about these. The only reason why they can find like good arguments against like the Danes and the Norse is like, oh no, they're stealing our women and they're so much wealthier and better at trade than us. Can you please make them go away?
Yeah. Yeah. So, speaking of them looking good and wearing sharp clothes and nice threads, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and this is something that bothers me when I watch something from Hollywood and it's depicting ancient Germanics, whether they be Teutons or Vikings or whoever. It bothers me when I see that their towns and their clothes are drab and brown or gray and just all earth tones, and there's no color about them. They're not wearing jewelry. They got dirty faces, and they just look like these dirty, moldy, nasty, backwoods, people. This is the absolute opposite of what these people looked like and how they dressed and how they behaved. And one of the things that was a big deal in Germanic culture across all of Greater Germania throughout all of time was the color of their clothing and the color of their houses too. And this is paint and dyes. These things were immensely important. The Norse placed great importance on the quality and also the appeal of their clothes and jewelry. They were like I've said this before. If ancient Germanics were around today, they'd be probably wearing Versace clothes, rolling around in a purple Cadillac with gold rims on it. Like these guys.
Well, they'd even specifically seek out dyes and pigments that were more expensive, just so they could have the prestige of wearing them.
Just so they could flex. That's they did that on purpose, just to show how it was a status thing for them. And they painted their house with these things too, just to flex, to say, "Oh, look, check me out. I'm big money over here. Don't play with me, because if I got big money, that means I got a big army too." You know what I mean? These guys, they loved wealth. Wealth was a big part of their culture. But what's really interesting is how they created these dyes and how painstakingly tedious it was to create some of these dyes and some of these paints. Now, when we talk about these pigments, we're talking that these guys went and they actually had entire mining operations to get things like cinnabar and malachite and vivianite and white lead and orpiment and things like that. Now, obviously, the cheapest one to make was charcoal, because they would just grind up charcoal and mix it in to make their stuff. They had brown ochre and iron oxide and stuff like that to make these pigments. But some of these pigments were really, really expensive to make. And these metallic pigments were mainly used for painting their houses. These people had a huge color palette that they would choose from. We're talking blues and greens and vibrant reds and yellows, and it probably been a little bit gaudy to us now to walk into a village and see all of these ridiculously painted houses, but this was their thing. They loved it. So they made this stuff, and when they made the paint pigments, they would mix it with some of that the glue that I mentioned earlier, the protein colloid kind of glue, or with coagulated milk and various processed types of eggs and stuff like that to make paint. They made sticky paint, real paint that would last for a long time, and they would paint their houses with these ridiculous colors to show off how much wealth they had. And when it comes to dyes and stuff, now when we talk about some of the expensive dyes and some of the ships and their reach and stuff, now most of the dyes they could make out of stuff that was available to them. Onion husks to make yellow, blackberries obviously make deep blues and blacks, and walnut husks to make yellows and oranges and browns, and madder root and nettle and weld. Weld is actually a flower. It makes a very nice vibrant yellow orange kind of color. But the one thing, the most expensive color, and this kind of goes with ancient Rome. In ancient Rome, the wealthy people wore purple, because in order to make purple dye in ancient Rome, they had to harvest sea snails, which was really, really difficult back then. So in order to make purple dye, they had to harvest these sea snails and process them. It was very expensive. So if you wore purple, that means you dropped a lot of cash. You dropped a lot of dough to get your clothes looking purple. So you looked fancy and rich. For the Germanics, red, the really vibrant red, like a crimson or a scarlet color, was their most expensive dye. And the reason for this was because it was made out of insects called cochineals or cochineals. I don't know how people actually pronounce it, but they're these little tiny insects, and they have a high, they're like 18 to 25% carminic acid, which is, you know, it's what makes the red color in these things. So these cochineal insects. Now, the theory is that one of two things, because these insects are only really native to North and South America, mainly in their highest density of population is found in like Peru. And they're also found in they can be found in Florida and Georgia and places like that as well, like the southern, more humid, temperate areas of North America. And they get sparser and sparser the further up you get with these insects. So the one theory is that these insects were around at in like the Slavic regions, because they have a similar kind of climate around the steppe. So they believe that the Germanics, especially the Bronze Age Germanics, actually got these things ordered in, or the powder, which was used to make the dye, in from, we're talking Poland and stuff and places like that, the greater Baltic areas. They believe that these insects were around back, because they found some archaeological evidence that they were around a long time ago. So therefore, it's possible that they were there around the Bronze and Iron Age, and then died out after some of the, like the Maunder Minimum and some of the smaller ice ages during the 16th century, because, the 15th century. And then these things, the use of this dye didn't reemerge in Europe until the 16th and 17th century, after Spain conquered South America and brought these insects back, the powder made from these insects back from South America. And to give you an idea of how expensive and how hard it was to make dye out of these things, you know, you probably make a thing of dye out of like a tablespoon of this stuff. Well, these insects, they're very small. They're about the size of maybe a housefly, smaller than a housefly, I guess half the size of a housefly. They're very small insects. About 70,000 of these insects go into making this powder, because, number one, only the females have this high concentration of this carminic acid that's used to make the red. Only the female bugs make this. And so it's only like half of the population of the bugs. And number two, you have to go through a big process. You have to like steam them, and then
Like it would be very difficult to even figure out which bugs are female and male. Like, how do you even do that?
You can't. You just have to get a huge amount of them, and then just, you know, the males go in there and do nothing, because you can't separate them. So they would steam these bugs, very, very large amounts of them, dry them out in the sun, and then grind them up into this powder. And 70,000 of these bugs made 1 pound, 1 pound of powder, and each powder took a tablespoon to make a vat of dye. So consider how expensive and how painstaking it was to make this bright red dye. So the two theories is that, one, that they got it from the greater Baltic area and brought it in just to have it and flex on people with their bright red clothes. A second theory is that they got it from the Americas and they can't explain how. They have no real definitive answer to how the Norse and the Germanics had this red dye, had access to this cochineal red dye coloring, but they did, and they had it, and they used it a lot. So either they had trade in the Americas before we knew that they did. We're talking, they had this in the Bronze Age, so either they got it from the Baltics, or Bronze Age Germanics Teutons were making trips to North America that we don't know about. Either or, they had this stuff. It was extremely expensive. We're talking really, really expensive, and they used it, and they loved it, and it was a symbol of status. So this is how they used this is what they made their dyes out of, mostly organic things, but also, as I mentioned before, like things like cinnabar and iron oxide and malachite and vivianite and stuff like that. So that is how they used their pigments. That is how they made their paints. And color palettes were immensely important to Germanics, whether we're talking Bronze Age people or Iron Age into the Viking Age.
Yeah, absolutely. And even like I know that in places like Scandinavia, in the medieval period, at least, and I also think that this is applicable to the Viking Age, that even poor people, the poorer people, and even like really destitute people would still color their clothing. Of course, they wouldn't have the vibrant blues and the purples and the reds of the nobility, but they would color their clothing with things like certain types of lichen and certain types of moss, which gives a very brownish, greenish color to them as well. So that they were able to make dyes for clothing and simple paints out of a myriad of different materials.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Mr. Andre, did you have one more? Because we're running out of time here.
I was just going to touch on something very quickly. I was going to mention on a similar note to what Tristan mentioned with the magnetic compass. Obviously, probably not everybody had access to something like a magnetic compass. A lot of people also used like a solar compass, like a solar clock almost. You could just place it in a bucket of water and be able to tell where the sun was according to the designation on the solar circle, essentially. And if you know where the sun is, you know where you're going. That's a very basic knowledge if you're doing like large travel or something like that, like widespread travel. Being able to know where the sun is, you can be able to tell where you're going, because the sun always starts and it always sets in the same directions. On a similar note to this, there is a kind of like a mythical aspect to one of these objects, and it's called a solar stone. Some people might be familiar with it, some people might not be, but it's essentially a quartz-like crystal. It's a very transparent crystal that is found in Iceland. If you use this and you hold it between your fingers, you have like a piece of it, and you hold it between your fingers and you reach up to the sky, even if the day is cloudy and it's like really cloudy, there might be a storm brewing, you don't know where the sun is. You're essentially out of luck because, okay, I don't know where the sun is, I don't know where I'm going. This solar stone, because of its properties, its natural properties, you don't need to do anything with it. You can just hold it up to the sky and you can just look through it, and through the clouds you will be able to see the sunlight of where the sun is. That is a very simple but very ingenious way of being able to navigate by using the sun.
Incredible.
I guess I could also mention like a final like fun fact that at least the Norse also invented, that many people might not even consider, but that even has like precedent in mythology. And it's the ski. The modern type of ski that we use today was invented by the Norse.
That's incredible. Also, chess. Yeah. The game chess.
Well, they didn't invent chess, but they had they did play a type of chess, Hnefatafl.
Yeah, Hnefatafl. It's actually really complicated. It's not as fun as chess, honestly. Like, it's hard to get into.
Well, I don't know. I quite like it. I've played it, and it's really good. It's one of the few strategy games in which it starts one player off in a disadvantageous position.
It's a big brain game.
Well, absolutely is.
And they also had a game. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was like, I was just about to say, like, these people knew how to have fun because they were even ice skating at this time. They were using ice skates made of like antler horns and so forth.
Yeah. So these guys, they had games. They had, and also they had a game called Cube that was like bocce balls. If anybody's familiar with bocce balls. It was similar to that. These were people, like, man, these were not dumb people. We're talking about their games. We're talking about their little inventions. We're talking about, these are people that did a whole lot with very, very little. And they not only did they do a whole lot, but they dominated the known world with it. These were not primitive, dumb people. These were advanced, intelligent people that created engineering marvels. That made very many practical technological leaps in their time, and that really, really changed the world and led the world in the arenas of trade and warfare. They were unstoppable.
I guess another fun fact to add to that, though, in in that the trade monopoly of the Norse actually extended so far that you could say that the Norse had the primary export of ivory in the known medieval world. And then you might wonder, how on earth would they have that? Because where's the elephants in Sweden?
Amber as well.
Walruses.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Walruses. They hunted walruses extensively in order to supply ivory to the mainland Europe. So ivory from medieval times, 9 times out of 10, it's most likely walrus ivory, not elephant ivory.
Incredible. Incredible. All right, fellas, we are out of time. So really great episode. I love doing this kind of stuff, getting into the little nooks and crannies of the ancient world and seeing how our ancestors operated and how our ancestors really, really drove the ancient world to developing the things that we learn the most about in the late medieval periods and the Renaissance. And if you read history and you go to your history class, the Germanic people are kind of just an afterthought, like a little shadow that might get just brushed over, when in actuality they were the foundation, and their ingenuity and their innovations drove the world at that time. So that's going to be it for this evening, guys. Make sure to go to facebook.com/Iron Age Jodish if you want to go check out some authentic Vedic astrology. Really, really great stuff over there Neil John's doing. facebook.com/Iron Age Jodish. And if you decide to get your own birth chart, make sure to tell them Big Dave sent you. Go over to patreon.com/TheBog if you support The Bog. You want to see The Bog grow and you want to help us keep the lights on, man. Help us keep the lights on. It's not easy doing this and it takes a lot of time. So if you like what we do, you love what we do, you want to see us grow and keep going and The Bog keep going stronger, so go to patreon.com/TheBog. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. There's all kinds of stuff there. You get like a mug and a sticker and stuff when you sign up, and then also more importantly, you get RSS feed to every single RSS feed for audio for every single episode that we do on The Bog, plus much more exclusive content. You're going to have Valor Hall. You got stuff coming from Tristan and Andre. You got stuff coming from me. You're going to have some stuff coming from Focus Farmer very soon, too. So there's going to be a lot of exclusive content pouring in over there in audio form for your RSS feed. And then if you want to support The Bog another way, go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and get some really sweet merch, man. Good stuff. When I was looking for a place to give us good merchandise, I didn't want to send people cheap Chinese crap. So Spreadshirt actually has a lot of good American-made, European-made stuff, high-quality items. It's not crap. So go over there if you support The Bog, you want to see us grow and everything like that, and you want to get some sweet merch, go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. Get a t-shirt, get a hoodie, get a beanie, get a backpack, whatever you want, all kinds of stuff over there. And like always, I'm going to raise a horn. I have the horn this week. I forgot it last week, but I have it to our most exalted patrons, House Allen, Corey, and our very own Andre and his beautiful family. So much love, many blessings to each and every one of you. We couldn't do it without you guys. Hail.
Hail.
All right, everybody, that's going to be it for this evening. Make sure to tune in next week, next Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern, right here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell to check the next episode of The Bog, or you can go check out the upload over there on YouTube on the Dave Martell YouTube channel. Much love, many blessings, and many hails to each and every one of you guys. I'll see you next week.